WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The tune you're hearing is It's Time for Labor, the campaign theme music for the British Labour Party. It was composed by Michael Kamen, who also did the score for the movie Robin Hood. The Conservatives have a theme, which is a variation on Purcell's Rondo by Andrew Lloyd Webber. The Liberal Democratic Party theme was composed by the drummer of the band Bucks Fizz. America obviously has no corner on theatricality when it comes to political campaigns. Here in the States, the New York primary is the big news. In England, the big event is Thursday's general election. Conservative Prime Minister John Major is being challenged by Labour candidate Neil Kinnock and Liberal Democratic Party candidate Patty Ashdown. The Tories have ruled for 13 years. So how do the British elections compare to ours? We asked William Schmidt to join us from NPR's London Bureau. Schmidt is the London correspondent for the New York Times. The British campaign has officially lasted only 4 weeks. I asked Schmidt if he thinks the short time span of the British campaign season makes for a more sane approach than ours.
Well, in theory, the British approach is more sane. The election process, the campaign itself, only works out to be about 4 weeks from the time the prime minister actually calls the election until the time people go to the polls. But in fact, the process does stretch on a lot longer than that. There is so much uncertainty for months and months and months before the prime minister calls the election that, in fact, you already are in on a campaign footing prior to the election date being set. The British papers refer to this as the phony election, but it's as much a campaign as the primary process is in the United States. In addition, I think the way the press deals with the campaign here, in particular the tabloid press, that it does tend to magnify some of the more egregious excesses of the campaign process. I think at this moment, as we approach Election Day, looking around at the newspapers and looking around at what's going on here, I think things are probably as insane here as they seem to you in New York.
Well, you know, in the United States, there's so much big money spent on TV ads. I think that's one of the biggest expenses for the presidential campaigns. There aren't any TV ads in England. There's a law against candidates spending their money on TV ads?
Under British election law, you cannot buy advertising time on television for political purposes. The government allots each of the parties time to present their case. They give them free time. The Labour Party and the Conservative Party, for example, the two major parties, are given, I believe it is 5 free broadcasts. They can go up to 10 minutes. They can keep it at 5 minutes if they would like. These are often theatrically produced episodes. The Conservatives use John Schlesinger,
he's directed Midnight Cowboy and Marathon Man.
Exactly. The Labour Party used Hugh Hudson, who did Chariots of Fire. He also directed, put together a piece for them in the 1987 election. But that is about it as far as television. Just these party broadcasts, and other than that, the candidates, the parties, do not have access to either television or to radio for political advertising.
In the 30 and 60-second spots on American television, you're either going to see an extended campaign slogan or, as likely, a negative ad, you know, bashing your opponent. So since in England you don't have 30 and 60-second spots, you have up to 10 minutes, what are the presentations like? What kind of content do you find in those 10-minute broadcasts?
Well, they tend to revolve around a particular theme, so that the Labour Party a few weeks ago, for example, chose national health policy as a theme, and they devoted their 10 minutes to what they said were the failures of the Conservative administration to administer in a fair and efficient way the National Health Service. Now, that broadcast, in fact, became a political issue itself because the broadcast used kind of a docudrama format. They hired actors who took the roles of real-life people to describe, in this case, the situation of a young girl who had, according to the Labour Party, been denied an ear operation because of failures in the health service. As it turned out, when the girl's name was revealed, not something that the Labour Party wanted to do, questions were raised about whether, in fact, she had been the problems she had with the operation were the result of failures within the health service or were a bureaucratic error. The girl's mother came out and said that she thought that the Labour Party was misusing her daughter. So I guess all of this is just a long way of saying that even though the intent is good to remove this bogeyman of the paid political advertising, the quick negative spot, the perils still remain even within this system.
Oh, by the way, I know Andrew Lloyd Webber of Cats and Phantom of the Opera fame has written a theme song for the Conservatives. How is that being used?
Well, each of the parties have theme songs. And one of the arguments that you hear this time around is that the elections in the American fashion have become much more theatrical. And each of the parties hired composers to write theme music. The Liberal Democrats, the third party, the party with the least amount of money, hired a fellow who was a keyboardist for a pop group called Bucks Fizz. So they went kind of low scale, and they put together a piece called Liberal Democrat Fanfare. The Labour Party hired the fellow who wrote the soundtrack for Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, and of course the Tories went with the trump card, and that was Andrew Lloyd Webber. He did not actually compose the piece. He took a 17th century work by Henry Purcell and added some ruffles and flourishes and drum rolls. But every time John Major appears at one of his campaign rallies. And these rallies, by the way, like the Labour rallies, which are held with a traveling set in various cities through Britain, are very theatrical themselves, highly orchestrated. As he enters the amphitheater, this very dramatic music strikes up as he comes down to address the audience, often in the round.
Let's talk about the press coverage of the elections in England. You've got the tabloids and you've got the broadsheets. What's the tabloid coverage like? And by the tabloids, you know, we're not talking about weeklies in the supermarkets. We're talking about daily newspapers.
We're talking about mass circulation daily newspapers. Tabloid simply refers to the format, papers like the like New York Newsday that are just that size, as opposed to broadsheets, a full-size paper like the New York Times. The tabloid coverage is what it has always been here. It's dramatic. It's highly partisan. It's highly charged. The tabloids show their bias in their daily coverage. And the broadsheets are more circumspect, but I think it's important to note that there are different traditions and in fact, different expectations about British journalism as opposed to what we're used to in the States. So the idea that that you find opinions in your newspapers are not, I don't think people here react as sharply or as negatively to that idea as we do in the States.
Can you remember any particularly snappy headlines from the tabloids recently?
My favorite, I think, was the day that John Smith, who is the chief economic spokesman for the Labour Party, announced his strategy for Britain should the Labour Party win the election. And the next day, the Daily Mirror, which is a pro-Labour tabloid, ran a front page which consisted of photographs of homeless people, of closed hospital wards, of people in unemployment lines, And the headline above all of these photographs was, "Goodbye to All This," suggesting that should Mr. Smith and Labor get into office, as they hope, that magically all of these economic problems would disappear. In that same paper, on page 3, there was a photograph of John Major in a fish market, and it showed Mr. Major looking over a counter while a clerk displayed fish to him. It was some campaign stop. And the only caption on the photograph was, "Spot the fish face." So as you can see, these papers don't, they pull no punches, they take no prisoners when it comes to a political point of view. And this is not the first time. In the 1987 election, the same thing happened. The Sun, which is another mass circulation tabloid, which has a circulation of about 3.6 million, which is about the same as the Daily Mirror. The Sun is a Tory paper, and in 1987, among the articles that it ran during the election was an article with the headline, "Why I'm Voting for Kinnock" by Joseph Stalin. I never did see the copy, but but the headline, I think, got a point the point across to the readers.
In the United States, as we know, the personal lives of candidates have been investigated, and you had the Jennifer Flowers story causing big problems for Bill Clinton for a while. Any equivalents in England? Are the personal lives of the candidates under the same kind of scrutiny, and are people looking for scandal in the way they seem to be searching for it in the States?
No, they tend to stay away from that here. There was an episode before the campaign began in which Patty Ashdown, who is the head of the Liberal Democrats, confessed that he had had an adulterous affair several years ago. The confession was not altogether voluntary. Somebody had broken into the offices of his lawyers some many months ago, and among the documents that were stolen was an internal memorandum in which Mr. Ashdown had discussed this affair with his attorney. When the Liberal Democrats discovered that this document had fallen into the hands of the newspapers, they sought to enforce an injunction through the courts that would prevent the British newspapers from printing the story. But the rumors were flying. Everybody on Fleet Street and in Parliament knew that this story was out there. It was about to break. But there was an injunction forbidding its publication. They managed neatly to get around that by the story going to a paper in Scotland which was not covered by the injunction. Once the story ran, Mr. Ashdown then appeared at press conferences, admitted to the affair, and there was some discussion over the next several days about what this would mean. There were efforts to find the woman in question. She made herself available. There were a set of interviews. And several days later, the next time a poll was taken, Mr. Ashdown's popularity had shot up. When Mr. Ashdown was asked to explain this, he said that this was a reflection of the good faith and the understanding of the British people. I think the feeling that others had at the time was that when you're the third political party, any publicity is good publicity, and his name recognition certainly improved from that point on. That was probably the closest we've gotten to the American experience here, and it really didn't go any farther than that.
My guest is William Schmidt. He's joining us from London, where he's a correspondent for the New York Times. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, we're talking about the British elections. My guest is William Schmidt. He's the London correspondent for the New York Times. So what are the big issues in the campaign this year?
The dominant issue is the economy and what the Conservative government, after 12 or 13 years in power, has done to worsen or to improve the economic well-being of Britons. Unemployment is very high, as it is in the United States. Inflation has been down, but there have been record numbers of business failures, bankruptcies, housing foreclosures, and the central issue in the campaign seems to be the state of the British economy, and this for the Tories, for the conservatives, has been the most difficult issue to deal with.
In the United States, you have this anger, I think, that's been expressed at George Bush and his administration for concentrating so much on foreign affairs in the past few years at the expense, perhaps, of the American economy. I mean, that's what a lot of Americans have been expressing. Is there a similar kind of anger that's been expressed toward Margaret Thatcher and John Major?
Yes, there is. There are people who are very unhappy and angry about what's happened. There is a feeling among some people, I guess you could call them the British equivalent to the to Reagan Democrats. These are people who during the Thatcher era came over to her side. She attracted many people, middle class people, because there was a period in the 1980s when economic growth was strong, when people were encouraged to own their own homes, when breaks were given to people who live, for example, in public housing in order to buy their public housing so they could own their own homes. And many of these people now feel betrayed because they bought in. They bought property. They took on debt. Interest rates soared. They now find themselves stretched, and they feel that the government has not done anything to help them out of the situation. Whether that perception is accurate or not, whether in fact the Tories would have been able to do very much to deal with the kinds of economic tangle that they've now found themselves in, just as many of the industrialized nations have found themselves in an economic morass at this point, that's a more problematical question.
Last year at this time, George Bush seemed unbeatable because of the Gulf War victory, and that didn't seem to last for him very long in terms of his popularity in the polls. And I wonder if the Gulf War is figuring into the equation in the elections in Britain, and if so, how?
Well, there are really remarkable parallels between the situation in the States and the situation in Britain. John Major, like George Bush, was extremely popular here last year by all poll measures at the time of the Gulf War and in the period after the Gulf War. And those who like to armchair quarterback now say that the biggest mistake that John Major and the Tories made was not calling the election last year when they were riding this crest of popularity. They chose not to. The economic numbers at that time were still very, very bad, and I think there was their hope, much as the Republicans are hoping that that before November things will improve in the States. The conservatives were banking on an improvement in the British economy. The problem they had here is that the clock stopped running on them. You have to call the new election within 5 years of the last election. And the final moment, the last date that Major was looking at would have been May or June, and he had already committed himself by his own rhetoric to going for the April election, and there just wasn't time. The irony here is that if there is a recovery underway in Britain, slowly, grudgingly, as there seems to be in the States, and if Labour should win this week, they may likely get credit for what the Tories or simply international economic forces set in motion months ago.
Did you ever cover the elections in the U.S.?
Yes.
What are you doing differently as a reporter now in England than you did when you were covering campaigns in America?
It really isn't that much different in terms of the nuts and bolts of the coverage. You get on a bus, you travel around with a candidate, you listen to what he says or she says, and you are counseled by the spin doctors, which is one of these terms that's relatively new to the British experience, but they're all over the place now. You see them on television, you see them on the campaign. So no, the actual reporting of the campaign is the same. One difference, I think, is that you don't have quite as much access to the campaign as you do in the States. Space is much more tightly meted out. Often you can't get on the buses with the candidates.
So before we go, which aspect of the American campaign has made the biggest splash in the British press?
Well, the trials and tribulations of Bill Clinton continue to fascinate British readers, and the British reporters in the States have spent a lot of energy, it seems, and time dealing with these with this question. There is a fascination with Jerry Brown and who he is. We haven't seen much on George Bush recently, but then again, like the Republicans, the Brits are now watching the Democrats devour one another.
Would you like to wager who's going to win in the British elections?
I'll fall back on the conventional wisdom here now, which is that the race is so close, and this is what all the polls suggest at this point, that we may end up with what is called here a hung parliament. That is, that neither the Conservatives nor Labour will achieve a majority in the balloting on Thursday. That is, there's 651 seats. So, in order for a party to form a government, they will have to win 326 seats. And the polls now suggest that that both Labour and the Conservatives will fall short of that. The feeling is that Labour may well emerge as the larger party, and if it is to govern, it's going to have to form some sort of pact or a coalition with a third party. In this case, the party that's really holding, the people who are really holding the Trump card now, if this is the scenario, would be the Liberal Democrats, the third party. But they want to exact a price for this. And the price that they want to exact is what they call proportional representation. Under the British system now, whoever wins the first past the post system, they call it, whoever wins a parliamentary seat, the party that achieves the most vote, wins the seat in Parliament. Now, the Liberal Democrats came in second in more than 200 seats in 1987. They received some 20% of the vote, yet they only have 3% of the seats because they only won outright 3% of the constituencies. What the Liberal Democrats want from this election is a parliament that will be apportioned to some degree on the basis of the split in the popular vote as a whole.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
William Schmidt is a London correspondent for the New York Times. He spoke with us from NPR's London Bureau. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.